Hello and Hare Krishna. Welcome to this episode of Chasing Reality Podcast with me, Ryan Bissett, aka Ramananda Das.
As you know, one of my interests is in research into the question of mind and consciousness, because it seems to be like a feature of life. And actually, there's some new research coming out of the University of Southern California, just published in Nature Biotechnology, and it claims to be able to read your mind and even know what kind of mood you're in. So today we have with us Akundali Das, Vedanta philosopher with a speciality in consciousness studies, to apply some neurons on this topic. So Akundali, how are your brain patterns?
I think they must be in a decent situation because I'm feeling quite good. And thank you very much, Ryan, for inviting me along today.
Welcome. So I thought I'd just ask you a pretty basic question to start. What is the kind of overall understanding from this paper? What are they trying to get across? What's the investigation about?
Well, there's been a lot of work in recent years, very useful studies, where we're able to look at particular brain patterns in people's minds and to monitor those and to try and correlate them with what they are reporting to either see or hear, or in this case, in this particular paper from Southern California, it's trying to correlate it with their emotions. What are they feeling at a particular time? And they're doing that by filling in some kind of questionnaire and scoring their mood from 1 to 7. Now, what's happening is that the researchers have attached electrodes to their brains, or to the outside of their heads, rather, and are looking at the patterns that come from it.
Okay.
Now, each person's pattern is different, but they're able to show, if I was to kind of attach you up, I'd be looking at a pattern and say, just to kind of give some kind of symbology to it. Say I saw it as a shape of an X, then, and you said, I'm feeling really happy. Mm. I would kind of know that if I see this pattern of an X, you know, I could say, Ryan, I think you're happy. But if I was... If another pattern, say a circle, came up and I had previously been able to correlate that with you feeling miserable,
yeah,
I'd say, oh, Ryan, you're not in good form today. You know, so just by looking at the brain patterns, I can decode them, meaning that I can assign some meaning to them and been able to kind of give an analysis of your emotional state. Now, it's still pretty rough at the moment, but, and it will get better as time goes on. I think they reckoned that they were doing this for 7 subjects, and they could kind of get it right 75% of the time. So that's a good start.
Mm.
And these things will just become better and better. So is this mind reading? That's the question.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of brain reading, because it's an outside element like us with our computers and our electrodes, trying to look at what the brain has got in terms of its electrical activity and trying to decode that. So we're not actually decoding the mind, we're decoding the brain and trying to see what is the significance of these particular patterns.
Okay, so basically you're saying that it's decoding of the brain activity, not necessarily the mind.
Yeah, and the question is that even though I may see these patterns, I'm not experiencing the emotion that you are. So
yep,
the patterns aren't the emotion. And even the brain patterns inside you, are they will obviously correlate with the emotions that you say you are feeling. But who is the you that is experiencing the emotions? And what is the nature of felt emotion? This gets us back to the old question of qualia.
Mm.
That which we experience and how we experience it. And the big question, and often posed as the hard problem of consciousness, is how do we explain that what the brain has simply got is these electrical patterns of activity, but what we experience seems qualitatively different to just electrons and ions bouncing between our cells. So in the same way as we have a problem understanding how in our brain we have electricity, but what we experience from the visual data that goes into our brain is imagery. So our eyes obviously pick up light from the outside, so there is a picturesque scene out in the world. Light is coming into our eye, but that light is being converted into electricity. That electricity is coming from different cells, you know, the cones and rods in our eye. It has been fed down the optic nerve, it goes into the brain. And basically the brain's then just got a lot of individual electrical impulses, which then form a kind of pattern of electrical activity. Now, in the same way as these guys are analysing emotions, other researchers have looked at the patterns that come in and been able to say, well, I think you're looking at this particular picture because previously when you looked at that picture, we saw that type of pattern.
Okay.
So that's how they're relating it. But it's not that the picture is in your brain. All your brain's got is electrical activity. And I may be able to correlate that and say, well, that, you know, X shape correlates to this picture, or this X shape correlates to this mood or this sound, so I can correlate it. But the question is, why, if you've got electricity in your brain, why is it that you experience that as a picture? That is the kind of the nature of our experience as a self, as the subject of our life. I am the person experiencing what my brain has got, but in the form of a beautiful coloured picture. That's qualia. And it's inexplicable in terms of what's happening at the neural level, which why it remains the hard problem of consciousness, and why it really raises the question, can we actually explain what we experience from the brain? So here we've got a very good analysis of brain activity, and we are correlating it with what the person tells us they're feeling. But we are not able to explain how the brain activity could generate that particular mood.
Okay, I think I've got you. We went down the rabbit hole there. So it seems like you're saying that brain activity is correlated to a particular thing that I might be experiencing, whether it's a colour, or if we go further, we could say an emotional state, as they're saying in this paper. But correlation isn't necessarily causation. How can they explain it from this way of thinking?
Well, I think these sort of experiments give us, I think, a way of looking at it. So just as me as an outside researcher might be able to attach the electrodes to you and look at your brain activity and saying, I think that brain activity relates to such and such, and I might then try and construct the circumstances of a happy thing that might, you know, might be your emotions, or I might try to construct a picture that represents it. So it seems that there is some interface happening within us, and that, I suppose, we call the function of the mind, that the mind reads the brain data, but somehow or other is able to then convert that and translate it or represent that data as this thing we call qualia, the actual psychological mental content that then we say we experience. So when our eyes are looking at something, I say, I, as the subject self, see the picture. And I do, I see a picture. I see colours and forms and movement and all sorts of stuff. So I've got that picture. Or when my brain fires like this, it represents the emotion that I'm feeling. So emotion, like the other sensory experiences, is another type of qualia. So there seems to be something acting as an interface between the data of the brain and is presenting the qualia experience for the as something to be experienced by the self, by consciousness. So one way of looking at this and trying to address it is that there seems to be different functions happening. There's the brain functions, which we're looking at here. But there's obviously some kind of additional function which is translating brain activity, which is simply just electricity. It's not that different to what's going on buzzing around your house, you know, and feeding the light bulbs, etc. It's just that it's a biological form of that electricity. And it's probably more complex in terms of its patterns. But complexity or volume of brain electrical activity doesn't produce anything qualitatively different. So maybe there is a non-neural, non-physical mind acting as an interface. But even if that's an interface, we still have to address the fact that there is a further function, which is the observance of that mental content, those qualia. And that, we could postulate, is some kind of conscious entity, which acts as the subject of the experience. And at the moment, there is no way to tie either the mental content of qualia to neural activity causally, and certainly no way to demonstrate that the observer of consciousness is connected causally with the neurons. It looks like consciousness and the mind are utilizing the brain and reading its data in the same way as these researchers are doing it. So the mind brain reads and presents that for consciousness to experience.
Okay, so that, let me repeat some of that back. Let me see if I quite digested it. So from what you're saying, and I understand you're coming from a Vedanta perspective, so this is something else I'm interested in. It sounds like you're separating what is typically called, as far as I've read in different philosophical and scientific contexts, the brain is the thing. You're saying that you're separating it into brain activity, which is then interpreted and decoded by a mind, which provides this kind of quality or experience of the world, but it provides that to a particular person. And I say that's me, or you say that's you. So there are three almost kind of functions. I'm not sure if I've got the right terminology. So you did mention the word non-physical. Now I'm wondering, the brain, the mind, and the self, I think you called it, but which ones are you saying are physical and which ones are non-physical, and why is that?
Thank you. Your summary, I think, gives a good resume of what I was trying to indicate there. Yes, I mean, we know that the brain activity, the neural functions, they seem to work according to the known laws of physics. Now, we know that there's also some weird stuff going on in there at the quantum level, which is, you know, still to be explored more. But still, we know that we experience things differently to how the brain's got. Therefore, it behooves us to try and postulate what could do that. Now, there are plenty of theories that are trying to explain the presence of consciousness, or the existence of consciousness, the existence of this sense of self, in relationship to some kind of echo or mirage or, you know, epiphenomenon of the brain. But nothing has been satisfactorily even posited in that regard. The idea that consciousness is just some kind of emergent property coming out of the complexity of the brain is really saying nothing. That's kind of suggesting it's some kind of magical thing conjured up by activity we know not what. So that doesn't give us a scientific way in there. And rather, what the epiphenomenalism is saying is that consciousness and the experience of consciousness, i.e. qualia, is something so totally different to what we know in physics that it must be this other type of stuff, an epiphenomenon. So a lot of people thought, well, we don't want to go down that route. So now they're suggesting that actually maybe the self doesn't exist at all, because the self is so easily fooled into thinking what it is and what it is experiencing, so maybe it doesn't exist. But that's silly as well from a philosophical point of view, because it takes something real to be fooled by illusion.
Okay.
And it takes actually something real to be used as an illusion. So, yes, we may mistakenly understand what we know about the world, but that doesn't mean me who's doing the mistaking has got it wrong. I was listening to another podcast recently by a comedian philosopher, or a philosopher comedian, whichever way he prefers to look at it, called The Total Eclipse of Descartes. Great title. And he was looking at this point where he was trying, he actually gave a wrong analysis of Descartes' point of view. What he was suggesting is that Descartes said, we can't trust my senses. So the only thing I should trust is my inner voice. You know, the world can be misunderstood, but I need to trust my inner voice. That's not what Descartes said. Descartes actually was saying, I can't even trust my inner voice. All Descartes was able to establish, and it's a very important one, is that the only thing I can be sure of is that I am the person hearing my inner voice. What my inner voice may be telling me may be totally wrong, but I'm the person hearing it. So that philosopher was making a false distinction because he thought the mind was the only thing different from the body. And of course, I think Descartes fell into that trap himself. He thought about the body and he thought about the mind. Now, you mentioned my background in Vedanta, and the reason I have spent so many years and decades looking into Vedanta is because it's the only philosophical perspective that actually tries to analyze consciousness from something novel. That there isn't just the physicality of the body and brain, there isn't just this interface of the mind as a non-neural substance, but there's also a third element, that which is the conscious element, the self. And in Vedanta, they term that Atma, that that consciousness is a property of a type of non-physical, non-material stuff. Now, we don't know what matter is made of. We certainly don't know what something non-physical is made of. Yeah. You know, ultimately, we define matter in terms of its functions and properties. So let's not worry about what consciousness might be made of, but we need to recognize that it has a function, a property that does not seem to be found in physical stuff. Or at least it is not one of the physical properties we know of, mass, charge, spin, and so on. It's something essentially different. So I would postulate that using this model of the source of consciousness and accompanied by the interface of the mind and its mental functions in translating brain activity into qualia, we have a model then for understanding how we experience the stuff that our brain does. And I think that's really valuable, because at the moment we don't have a theory to tie it together. We just lump everything as the brain activity, as the mind consciousness, as all the brain. But we have no idea how to separate that out. And actually, in the same way as these researchers hope that through stimulation of the brain can help in various illnesses and disorders, so I think that's true, but it will be even more effective if we understand that dealing with the neurology is one element of the process, but often we have to deal with the psychology of the mind and how it is reading that same data. We can adjust the data, that might help, but we also need to adjust how we're decoding that data in order that consciousness, the self, has the best experience.
Okay, thank you very much. That was a very comprehensive answer. See, you're saying that, what I got from that was that you're saying we can fiddle around with the brain. For example, in this study, I noticed they were talking about applying an electrode at certain parts of the brain where we know need to be stimulated in order to kind of have more positive emotions. And that will trigger more depressive, people who are in a more depressive state to become more more happy and positive, which I thought was a really nice idea. You're saying that that's good, that deals with the data, And there's another layer we can go to as well. So you're adding something here, right?
Yeah, that's right. This kind of deep brain stimulation, DBS, has been shown to be effective. Now, it's generally posited as easing a condition. It's not curative on its own. And part of the reason that is because there is this other aspect, this other function of mind, which is trying to decode the brain stuff. A good example is, obsessive disorder, you know, where compulsive disorder, where we're looking at a situation where there may be some kind of glitch in our brain circuitry that fires, and that firing stimulates the mind to read that as a thought, which might be something as simple, did I lock my front door? Okay, so the mind has to cope with this pattern, and it reads it, okay, did I, you know, lock my front door? And it goes, yeah, yes, I did. But the brain fires again.
Mm.
So the mind is back to looking at that, did I close my front door? Yes, I did. I just had a thought about that. But then the brain fires again, and again, and again. And the problem with OCD is not this, it's not the specific problem with the brain. The actual discomfort or trauma of OCD comes from what happens within the mind as it deals with this thought again and again and again. And it just builds up into some real worry, fear, and actually terror. It is a terrible affliction. So they've shown that the best way to deal with OCD is a combination of two things. One is, yes, some kind of DBS, some stimulation that might break that that firing of that neuron pattern again and again and again. But at the same time, it has to be accompanied with training of the mind how to deal with that pattern and how to react to that pattern and interpret it and say, no, I don't need to actually pay so much attention to that. So when you've got the mental training along with the neurological kind of treatment, you've got the best overall way of dealing with any disorder.
Okay, I had something come to mind as you were speaking there. I imagined, you know, knockdown ginger. You know, someone's knocking on your door, or at least that's what they used to call it when I was young. And someone's knocking on your door, and you go, and no one's there. So the kids have run away. So eventually, you just stop answering the door. Is that kind of what you're saying? Is, you know, we need to, in certain conditions like obsessive compulsive disorder, we need to also, as well as doing preventative stuff in the brain and the patterns of electricity that happen there, we have the capacity to really train the mind. That seems like...
That's a really good example, you know, because that's exactly what we need to do. Say you've got a situation where you've got these brats down the road ringing your bell, and you're going to the door again and again and again, and eventually it's just going to drive you crazy. So you've got two ways of dealing with that, and you actually have to do both. But if you just chase the kids away, you know, you'll still be waiting for the doorbell to ring, and you'll still be fearing it and, you know, waiting for it. And if the doorbell rings, you'll begin, is this the beginning of another reign of terror by those kids ringing my bell every moment, you know? But if you just try and do it mentally, that's not enough on its own. You need to kind of work on both. So similarly, that's the best way of dealing with a lot of these issues of depression, anything related to moods, anything related to any troublesome way we have of decoding brain activity. We need to look at it in terms of both the neurology and see if there's some disorder at that level and maybe offering some help. But unless we deal with the mind's way of decoding that, you may find that the mind will get attached to some other brain pattern which will spark the same thing again.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm left, as always when we discuss, lots and lots of thoughts going through my brain, or should I say my mind. where are these thoughts going? And I'd like to thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ryan. All the best.
Thank you very much to listening to this episode with a wonderful speaker, Akundadi Das. Very, very fluent and able to get his points across in such a concise manner, which is very, it elicits a lot of qualia, if I may say so. So as you may have noticed, Akundadi Das and I are friends. We work together on this question of consciousness. He introduced me to the whole concept of qualia, and I owe a great deal of my understanding and getting into the field of consciousness and science to him. And he brought up many interesting questions today. His mission is to inform everyone about the importance of that little, how many letters is it? Q-U-A-L-I-A. Is that six? Six-letter word, qualia. And I'm sold. I'm totally sold. I think about it like this. Everything has a currency. So the bank deals with banknotes. Basketball players deal with basketballs. The brain deals in the currency of electrochemical signals. But the thing is, I don't experience the world in that way. I experience, and I hope you do, in a qualitative way. So my experience of qualia, obviously we can't understand, we can't speak about what it is to experience, for example, the redness of red. But I know that it isn't reducible to some kind of electrical signal. There's certainly a correlation there. That's why these studies which have been coming out on mind or brain reading are very interesting. But again, it comes back to these terms of mind and brain. We have to be very careful when using them. And certainly I do, because I'm not a philosopher of mind. And I'm looking forward in future episodes to discussing with such people and hopefully really kind of expanding this discourse a bit further. Okay, have a good evening or day wherever you may be in the world. Hare Krishna.